Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC here on ESPN Plus. I'm Dan Thomas. Sid Lowe with us a little later on to talk about plans in Spain to get La Liga going sooner rather than later. Meanwhile, we take a trip down memory lane with Mr. Gab Marcotti talking about that Chelsea team that won the Premier League back in 2005 and whether or not we give that side enough credit. Craig and Don, though, will be here in a moment to talk about the announcement today that the Premier League are still very much committed to finishing the 2019-2020 season. They met today. There was speculation about what they would conclude. There will be a vote, though, on May the 8th to decide how they will go forward, but they will not be following in the footsteps of France, who, of course, earlier in the week called off their season. Now, I want to bring your attention to a tweet that Craig put out just earlier today, talking about the return of Premier League, saying, can't see a feasible pathway for the Premier League this season. It's folly to try and play the games in the current climate, scrap the season and concentrate on the 2020-21 and a way forward financially for all involved. Well, let's welcome in Donna and Craig now. Craig, why the rush? Why do you feel it should be stopped now?
Because I think we're at a point where we're in danger of, amongst other things, disrupting the following season as well. And I think, you know, you mentioned France. They've made a decision. You mentioned the Premier League. I'm not going to go down that road. I would say at this moment in time, I think it may be inevitable that they will have to go down that road. When I say scrap the season, I don't mean void the season. I mean, they work out the placings in regards to points per game where we are now, i.e. Liverpool would be the champions. But, you know, as we speak now, there's been over 27,000 deaths in the UK, Dan. And in the last 24 hours, more than 700 more deaths alone. So clearly, we're not getting on top of this, and Britain is not the only country. And for the Premier League to be, well, they can think of it still playing, but I think realistically, it's about next season for the safety of all involved. And even if that was to be the case and potentially play in the first weekend in September, say, I still think that's a rush. I still think that's a doubt.
But why the timeline? Why can we not say July the 1st, for example, get things back up and running, play the games over the week, two, three matches a week, then we're going to catch up? Why is next season a priority over this one that's almost done?
Well, we don't know if we're going to be able to play by that time. Players are going to be out of contracts as well. We've got a transfer window. We've got so many things to think about on top of people losing their lives. So I just think there is, this pandemic has been too problematic, has been too severe. There is a lack of getting a handle on it, no matter what governments will tell you, because people are still dying at an alarming rate. And I think you've got to look further forward than the next few weeks. And I think somewhere down the line, you've got to make a decision. Some countries have done that. And I think inevitably, the Premier League and others may follow suit.
Don, what's your thoughts on it?
I just think it's a little bit hasty if we make a decision now. I think we've got loads of time. I take every single thing on board what Craig said. And it's actually difficult to argue when you talk about human lives being lost. It is difficult to try and put forward a sporting possibility. But I think for the Premier League, they're doing the right thing. They're trying to wait like everyone. We're living in this pandemic at the moment, hour by hour, day by day, and things will change. It will maybe get worse for a day or two, and maybe then get better. We don't know. That's the climate we're living in. So the Premier League, like any other industry, they are trying to put plans into place for whatever happens down the road. And we don't know how long that's going to be. So I just think, you know, the 1st of May is very early. As you said, Dan, in your question to Craig there, we could leave it another month or two. There's no rush, really. We don't have to live by the guidelines of Premier League starting when it normally starts. You know, next season could be put back by 2, 3, 4 months. It might have to be the case. It's a really unusual scenario we find ourselves in. And it's going to take a lot of heads to get together and come up with the right decision. But, you know, it's pointless rushing into a decision today where we cancel the league and we award Liverpool the league and no teams go down or whatever the scenario, if then in, say, 2 weeks' time or a month's time or 2 months' time, we then find a cure. So I think we have to be a little bit more patient. I know everyone wants answers now, and that's just the world we live in, but we have to be more patient.
Don, you're putting the season back potentially 2, 3, 4 months. You don't even know if you're going to be able to finish this season. You're disrupting then two seasons at least. You've got the Euros next summer. There are all sorts of logistical issues that would entail, rather than just doing what other countries have done and say, listen, we are going to finish the season on sporting merit, on points per game. I know it's not fair, but this is not a fair scenario. Liverpool are going to be champions. I know a lot of people, particularly United fans, have a problem with that. But, you know, from a neutral point of view, I don't. I don't think we should be relegating teams. And people will say, well, how can you hand the title out and then not relegate teams? And I think the legality of the relegation is way more complex than giving a team a title at the other end. I think what the Premier League and other leagues will be doing is trying to negate the lawsuits that will come. And inevitably, there will be some. But they're going to try and negate as many of those as possible. And I think the Premier League, for example, could be inflated at least for one season by two or three teams from the Championship. And we would have, you know, five or six teams been relegated next season to get it back to 20 teams. But that is just where we are at the moment. And I think to make a decision... And I don't mind them waiting another couple of weeks, but I don't want to be waiting another 6 weeks. But I think a decision will have to be made soon. And I don't have a problem with finishing this season. I'd love to see it been played. I, as much as anybody, do not want the season to be cut short. But it is what it is. Unless a magic vaccine pops up in the next 48 hours, this thing's not going to go away. And I just think to disrupt two seasons and put people's health at risk is way too big a challenge than just saying, listen, we need to take this on the chin. We need to have the priorities of everybody involved at stake here and make the correct decision. And I think to try and disrupt two seasons and get some games played behind closed doors and put people's safety at risk, it's just too much to ask.
There's going to have to be something that goes on, and logistics is not my forte, so how on earth you try and do it? But obviously we've got a World Cup, a Winter World Cup and the Premier League coming up in 2022, so maybe... You know, maybe you could use that and try and shift the dates. And as I said, logistics are very hard, and trying to get your head around when the games and shifting the World Cup and all of that would actually happen. But that has to be shifted. The Premier League at some point in a Winter World Cup is going to have to come up with something in 2022 when the World Cup goes ahead. So, I'm trying to be positive, Craig. I hear what you're saying, and it's hard to actually, you know, argue the point. I'm just trying to be really positive. I'm trying to also be patient. And at the same time, I'll still go back to what I think the Premier League stance is. They're like any other industry. They're waiting for the World Health Organization and the government guidelines to try and then give them a better idea on what to do going forward.
Don, where do you stand on Craig's point of view regarding Liverpool as champions, Champions League places as it is, and then relegation doesn't exist? However, it would be what Leeds and West Brom who would come up.
It's very hard. I mean, take a case in point if we just go off piece slightly. I mean, the Eredivisie was cancelled the other week, and Ajax were awarded the title. Now, the team that were in the second division were 11 points clear, and they were going into the Eredivisie. Now, they're putting a legal case forward to try and say, this is not right. So, I think the easy part is giving Liverpool a title. I think that's the easy part. However, I think... other fans would probably use that against Liverpool, not in the immediate term, because it's a tragedy that we're living in at the moment. But they'll probably say to Liverpool, you didn't really win the title, did you? The season wasn't really completed, were you? Was it? And then you go into the teams that are in the bottom three. I mean, you can't relegate teams in the bottom three. Aston Villa come to mind. They're sitting in the bottom three with a game in hand. They win that. They're at the bottom three and safe. So... I just think for that reason, and not only that reason, but these sort of reasons where we're mentioning the legalities of it, it would just be incredibly messy and hard to deal with. Not nigh on impossible to deal with if you're just going to award Liverpool a title, the teams that are in the positions for Champions League and Europa Leagues, and then relegation spots. I think it's very, very hard to try and solve.
The trouble is, Don, I don't think we should be worried too much about what other fans are saying about, you know, how Liverpool got the title. And I've seen it all on social media, all the nonsense with the asterisks and all that. It's not the most important point. Of course, the relegation, I think, you know, you have the Champions League places and Europa League places. They are important, you know, financially as well. But the relegation and promotion is really the big issue. What we've got to dilute here is, it's not just the Premier League, right? Because if we're talking about playing these games, we're talking about then relegating these teams, right? And the scenario I'm talking about, the teams don't get relegated. At least two, maybe three teams come up, and then we dilute the division back to 20 the year after. If you try and play these games and relegate these teams like Villa, like Norwich, like Bournemouth and clubs like that, that's fine. That's fine. But then you have to have all the games in the Championship to keep that on an even keel. And then you've got to have all the games in League One so that the whole thing's moving evenly and the logistics are working. That's a heck of a lot of football. So we're not just talking about the Premier League here. Because if the Premier League play and relegate teams, the rest of the leagues are going to have to follow suit. There's no other way around it. And so therefore, that's one of the main issues. It's not just a Premier League problem. Mm. It's a problem that filters all the way down to non-league football.
But I think for that reason alone, and you put forward a very good case, but I think for that reason alone, that's why I don't think we should rush into stopping the league now. That's why I think we should give it the maximum amount of time as we can. And that's what I'm pretty sure that's what the Premier League will be thinking. Let's not be hasty. Let's not cancel the season now. Let's try and wait as long as we can. And if we have to wait maybe another month or another 2 months maximum or 3 months, whenever, then so be it. Because as you said, Craig, people are losing lives. So it's not an easy decision to make. And that's why it hasn't been made. So I'm pretty confident that the Premier League will do the right thing.
Amongst all of this, we haven't really talked about the players. We had Kun Aguero coming out and giving his reservations about returning to action. I'm just intrigued, if you were playing still, Craig, how much would you be on board playing tomorrow?
I probably would. And I don't say this flippantly, but, you know, and I don't know if Don would, I'm not putting words in his mouth, but we're kind of old school in that way. And we'd probably, you know, within reason, we'd probably just get on with it. I saw the quotes from Sergio Aguero, and he's not alone. And here's the other issue, Dan, that, as I said, no matter what governments around the world say, we're still not on top of this. You've got Paulo Dybala at Juventus, who's apparently tested positive for this 4 times. We can test people all we want at the moment, but we really don't know. We've got our head in the sands. In terms of what we know about this virus and who's got it and will it come back and antibodies. So it's not crystal clear. That's my point. That is my point in all this. So there's a waiting process, but there's also an understanding. And so if somebody like that can be positive 3 or 4 times, been tested regular, who the hell knows what's happening with everybody else at these grounds, even with games played behind closed doors. So there's so many factors to think about. That's why I think it should be clear, the Premier League and others, and making a decision saying, we have tried our best to finish this season, but it doesn't look as if it's going to be possible. So we're going to take all our resources. We're going to try and soften the blow as much as possible for all the leagues and all the clubs as best as possible. But it will never be totally unfair. And we're going to move forward to hopefully next season, where late August, September, we can make a start. And as I said earlier in the show, I think that is even debatable.
Last word on this, Son. How would you feel returning to action?
I would be back in a heartbeat. I'm like Craig. I'm old school. I would want to play. I can't imagine what I would be doing in this lockdown. The players are trying to keep as fit as they can. But the old school in me would say I would want to be back as quick as possible.
Gents, thank you very much. A lot more from Craig and Donna, of course. On Extra Time today, they'll be answering your tweets. You can check that out over on our YouTube channel.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with GEICO. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Ready to play, that's the front page of the Catalan newspaper Sport. Optimistic stuff regarding the return of La Liga. Sid Lowe with us from Madrid. Sid, what's the plan?
Well, the plan is a series of steps to lead us to a position in which clubs can start training in the next week or just over that. And the plan to start with, at least, is that on Monday and Tuesday of next week, there will be a series of inspections at training grounds to make sure that they comply with La Liga's protocol on things like disinfecting, in things like access, in terms of the way that kits are laid out, the terms of the way that the players have access to the training grounds, and how those entry points are staggered so that there's not too much coincidence of players with each other. Then after that, the hope is they spend a couple of days doing tests to get a very clear sense of what position they're in, what players have kind of what level of immunity, which players maybe still have the virus, if indeed they ever had. And then from there, the hope would be that they could start individual training sessions. And it's important to stress that individual training sessions at the club's training camps on either the 8th or the 11th. In other words, just before the weekend or just after the weekend. Now, the reason why this is different to those previous dates that have been set, to those previous discussions of when things might happen, is that for the first time now, we're in a situation in which La Liga's protocol more or less fits with what the government is planning to do. The government's been talking about a reduction of the lockdown in terms of relaxing some of the rules, allowing people out. For example, this weekend, for the first time, Spaniards will be allowed out of their homes to do exercise. And that has explicitly talked about the position of professional athletes. And so for the first time, we're now in a position where what the government are saying and what big sporting institutions, in particular in this case La Liga, are saying is broadly in step. And so as of next week, assuming there's no problems the next 3 or 4 days, this should start to get moving.
Meanwhile, we're hearing both sides, aren't we, the arguments when it comes to players returning. This is what even Rakitic say, front page of Marca here, the Barcelona midfielder, saying, "I'll take the risk of playing. It'll be the same as any worker." Meanwhile, Valencia's Gabriel Paulista coming out on Instagram and saying, "We will play when no one does it out of fear and when we have complete guarantees that there are no risks." Both sets of real opinions there, Sid.
Yeah, and I think what this does, this contrasting of these two opinions from Gabriel and from Ivan Rakitic, is it tells you that footballers do not all feel the same way. You know, I think we sometimes forget this. We tend to talk about footballers and what footballers want, but you're talking in the first division. Every single club has 25 players. There's 20 clubs in the first division. That's a lot of footballers, and they don't all feel the same way. In particular, of course, the contexts here are different. Valencia were the club that most hard hit by this. They had a series of players test positive for COVID-19. They were the ones, of course, who went to Milan to play against Atalanta, that had Atalanta play against them at Mestalla behind closed doors. So that sense of, if you like, the kind of the sensibility to towards this is different in each case. I also think as well that they're not actually as far apart as it sounds like. I think the question mark would be when Gabriel talks about complete safety, the ability to be absolutely certain that no one will get ill. Well, there's no way of being certain that anybody in any walk of life will get ill. But of course, part of the La Liga's protocol is designed to prevent this, because they know that it's one thing to get started. It's one thing to try and get teams back into training. But of course, if that process is halted at some stage, if that process falls apart at some stage, then the season won't get completed. So it's not enough just to start. They need to be able to complete it. So some of those guarantees, some of those safety checks that Gabriel wants, I think probably will be put into place.
Sid, it's the first time we've had you on since, for example, France cancelled the league. They won't be playing until September. Germany, though, more optimistic. The Premier League still very much in discussions. In Spain, what's the general vibe about the return of La Liga?
Well, look, it's quite difficult to judge that. I mean, exactly as you've just been showing with Ivan Rakitic and Gabriel, there are different points of view. And immediately after the announcement in France, I think there was a sense here in Spain that, okay, this is coming here soon now. If France are giving up, the chances are Spain will give up. However pugnacious, however determined, however kind of bullish the president of the league, Javier Tebas, is, and he's been incredibly bullish all the way through this, I think most people think that he's been unrealistically bullish, that he's, of course, doing this out of a desire rather than necessarily reality. But I think the fact that 2 days later, the head of the government, Pedro Sanchez, announced a series of de-escalation processes, a four-stage plan to come out of lockdown and to go towards what he's describing as a new normality, and the fact that that fit with La Liga's plans, the fact that there was then a task force meeting between the Consejo Superior de Deportes, which is effectively the sports ministry, with the league, with the federation, with the players union, with some clubs, with a whole series of other sporting bodies as well, and that there was an agreement that most of what had been proposed to the government could happen, I think shifted people's mentalities, and I think made people think, okay, actually this could happen. Now, that's not to say that everybody's behind it, that everybody wants it to happen, that everybody believes that this is the right thing to happen. Because, of course, right now there are far more important elements. But there is a very definite sense that the curve is going in the right direction, that there is the beginning of an opening up on lockdown, and that football can be part of that. Now, nobody doubts that when and if football returns, it will do so behind closed doors, that it won't be quite the same thing. But I think most people now believe, actually, at the very least, they're going to try this. You know, they'll have the return to training. If those processes can be fulfilled properly, then I think there is a certain optimism now that La Liga's plans, which is for the competition to start by the middle of June, can actually go ahead.
I know what you're missing, Sid, during all of this is a good old comparison between two players. Let's go for one in Atleti, one at Real Madrid. Talkers Christian Carlsen, of course, put out this list. Top 10 players under the age of 21. Vinicius Jr. coming in at 4. João Felix, meanwhile, very much at the bottom of that top 10. Is that disparity fair?
Do you see that thing over there, Dan? It's a fence. I'm going to go and sit on it, as I always do. Well, I think, look, whenever you start doing a ranking, it's problematic. But I must admit, I think this probably contradicts what many people in Spain would say, because I think there's been a huge excitement about João Felix. But actually, on this season's performances, I think this is justified. We've not seen enough of João Felix. There's all sorts of question marks about whether that's because of him, because of the structure, because of the kind of manager that Diego Simeone is, because of the lack of freedom he's had, or the difficulty in adaptation. There are some doubts about Vinicius as well, but those fundamentally, I think, reside in his kind of ability to remain calm in the penalty area, his finishing ability. But he's tremendously exciting. He goes at people, he's relentless, he keeps on playing, he's prepared to run and run and run again and take people on. And there's no doubt there's been pressure on him. We saw it back in September, I think it was, when he scored and he broke down in tears because the pressure had been on him so much. And I think while there are flaws in his game, I think there's a kind of a raw talent there that's very, very exciting. There's no doubt that João Felix has it as well. But right now, in the immediate future, I think it's legitimate to have Vinicius ahead of João Felix, yeah.
Sid Lowe, thank you very much. Tor Christian Carlsen, by the way, joins Gab and Jules on the latest edition of the podcast to defend his top 10. You can download that now. Would you believe it's 15 years this week since Chelsea won their first Premier League title, and boy, did they do it in some style. Let me just throw some stats at you. This is the most points in a season, 95, which was only broken a couple of seasons ago by that Pep Guardiola side. Won 29 games in that campaign, 25 clean sheets. They can see the fewest Premier League goals, just 15 in the season. They weren't defeated at all at home. They just lost one match all campaign. And they finished 12 points ahead of Arsenal. And what we've got to remember as we welcome in Gab and Don to the show, this was an Arsenal side that were invincible, of course, going into the start of this season. Chelsea came in, and sometimes, Gab, do we forget how good this team actually was?
Yeah, I mean, I don't forget it because that's a team I covered closely, as well as the year before. I mean, the entire Abramovich era. But obviously, Abramovich had come in all guns blazing the previous summer. They finished second the year before under Claudio Ranieri. And had they not lost their head-to-head against Arsenal, had they won that, they might have actually won it that season. Had they not thrown away the semifinal against Monaco the year before, they might have even won the Champions League, and we'd have a different history now. But I mean, that was the base on which Mourinho built, and Mourinho just took it to another level. Tremendous signings. Cech and Robin had been signed the year before, but, of course, arrived that summer. Carvalho at the back, and, of course, Didier Drogba up front, really making all the difference that season.
Don, why do we overlook them? We talk about the Manchester City team that broke the 100 points, obviously, Manchester United, 1999, the Invincibles of Arsenal. This team were up there, though, weren't they?
Oh, they certainly were. I was at West Ham at the time, and it was a difficult one because you never quite were sure if the juggernaut of Abramovich and Jose and Chelsea were going to go and kick on and be as good as what they were, because we were sort of looking at the likes of Man United being strong for many a year, Arsenal being strong, Liverpool having the history, and you always felt as though as a player they would come back one day. But the Chelsea side, my recollection, were just big, strong men. I mean, terrific footballers. I mean, they could mix it. Whether you look back at the Invincibles of Arsenal a year before, And I was, and I'd done it earlier, I was looking at the two sides, and they're very similar. If you're a Thierry Henry fan, you can argue a case of Didier Drogba. If you're a Vieira fan, you can argue the case of Makélélé. If you like Sol Campbell, you can argue John Terry. And the list goes on, by the way. But I think maybe the Invincibles were a little bit more stylish. I think in their system, 4-4-2 with Lundberg and Perez had a little bit easier on the eye with Bergkamp. I think with Chelsea, they were in a 4-3-3 at the time, and they were just dismantling sides for fun. But all breaking all the records that you said, Dan, keeping clean sheets, fewest goals conceded, they were incredibly tough to beat. But my recollection, standing in the tunnel next to these guys, the majority of them were huge, and they were, on their day, as the record suggests, nearly unplayable, all but that one game.
Gab, you made a good point in that you brought up all of the players that came in during the summer, all of them pretty much new to the Premier League. This somewhat tore up that myth, didn't it? Oh, it takes time to adapt to English football. It's a very different style. This team came in, hit the ground running, and destroyed the defending champions who were invincible the season before.
Yeah, I mean, look, this whole thing about adapting and style, you know, those differences, which were very stark in the past, I think, are diminishing year on year. I think the fact that Mourinho was new, and look, Mourinho has his critics these days, and I'm certainly among them when I think he screws things up. But people forget just the impact that he had in that first season. You know, that Chelsea side, yes, they hardly conceded anything, but they wore you down, and they played some really modern attacking football at times. You know, the way Damien Duff and Arjen Robben out wide, the way those two guys combined, the way the fullbacks also helped, the runs from midfield of Frank Lampard. It was so much quality in that time, and there's such attention to detail as well. You know, what people often forget about the Invincibles is that was an outstanding team, but you know, that was also a team that drew, I think 12 games that season. You know, this Chelsea team went, and then they went there, they went for the jugular, and most of the time they beat you. They went the whole season, they only lost that one game.
Don, what was it like? You mentioned before, just give us a little more detail going up against this sort of team.
Yeah, it was. I'll take you back to the year before in the Invincibles, and going back even one or two years before that. When you played against the very best Arsenal side, you stood in a tunnel, and I used to stand next to probably Patrick Vieira when I was playing against him, and you think, right, you know, how can I try and get the best out of my opponent today? Can I try and run him into the channels where he doesn't want to be? Well, no, he could do that. What's he going to do to me? Well, he can outrun me. He's probably physically stronger than me. He's probably better on the ball. So you try and have to come up with things. And you look along the line at that great Arsenal side, and there's 11 of them. Now you fast forward a year, and it's almost like my recollection of that season or that period was Arsene Wenger had the formula to be and to take Arsenal to one of the best Premier League sides of all time. And almost within 18 months, he sort of threw that formula in the bin, and he went for the more diminutive players, and he tried to make them sort of Barcelona-esque. And Jose came along, and one man that we must give a quick mention to, I think, is Claudio Ranieri, because he was building this Chelsea side just before Jose come in. And then Jose went in that bin, and he took Arsenal's formula. He brought in the big players. You know, Lampard was already there and the likes of Terry, but he had Drogba and he had Makélélé. And all of a sudden, he just went and got that formula of Arsenal's, stole it, replicated that over a short period of time, and took this Chelsea side, you know, to greatness. It's bizarre, really, how we don't give this Chelsea side that won the title in 04-05 a lot more love, really.
And let's not forget as well, Gab, pretty much the decade leading up to this season, it was a coin flip as who was going to win it, United or Arsenal. Those two had been so dominant.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, until that point, only three teams had won the Premier League in the previous 13 years. You had that one crazy season of Blackburn winning, and obviously they were very well bankrolled with Sutton and Shearer and whatnot. And otherwise, it was basically a monologue from Manchester United. And then, you know, those two tremendous Arsenal double-winning sides. And so, you know, the fact that Chelsea could come in and shake it up. I mean, younger viewers will remember, obviously, the impact Manchester City had when they came in and threw enormous amounts of money and quickly sort of hit the ground running and assembled a team. I'd almost argue Chelsea did that quicker than City. different circumstances, of course. But, you know, from Ranieri's first season, where he'd been there before, but, you know, all of a sudden the team were hugely competitive, to obviously Mourinho's first season, where he just went and he built them and he took them to another level. And really, I don't like it when people bring up sort of, you know, they talk about winning mentality and metaphysical stuff. I like stuff that I can see and measure. But there is no question that there was an intimidation factor to that Chelsea team, and really a winning mentality and attention to detail that really made all the difference. That, you know, once they got rolling, the momentum they built, really, really hard to stop. And let's not forget, they also reached the Champions League semi-final, where they eventually, yeah, they lost to Liverpool 1-0 on aggregate with that goal, the so-called ghost goal that Jose Mourinho is still complaining about today.
Gav Marconi and Don Hutchison, thank you very much. Now, we're going to take tomorrow off. We'll be back, though, in 48 hours' time for the next edition of the show. Be sure to join us.
GEICO knows there are many reasons why you ride. From the camaraderie of the other bikers, a band of brothers always there for you, rain or shine, to the amazing savings you get with GEICO on your motorcycle insurance and accessories coverage all year round. But for Bucky Hornhill, it was one reason in particular.
It was my helmet hair. I was born with helmet hair. I've tried to cut it a bunch of times, even buzzing it, but it immediately just goes back to helmet hair.
GEICO Motorcycle. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Napa Know How.
Father's Day knickknacks, that funny mug, ironic tie, or worse, IOU coupon books. It's time to get yourself something you want, Dad, like a Craftsman half-inch corded impact wrench for $99.99. It's the perfect gift to give to yourself. And while you're here, don't forget to shop all our great deals on Craftsman tools. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know How.
Napa Know How.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores while supplies last. Offer ends 6/30/20.
Be sure to go over to our website. There's plenty of bonus material over there for you to enjoy. One that's just dropped. Adrian Healy chatting to Claudio Reyna and Josh Wolf about the new MLS franchise, Austin FC. Also on our website, a series of quizzes, including our Serie A battle between Gab Marcotti and Stuart Robson. I call it a battle, but really it was one-way traffic. Here's a taste.
Cristiano Ronaldo is one of two players to score a hat-trick in Serie A, La Liga, and the Premier League. Who was the first?
Mario Balotelli.
Incorrect. Who did Balotelli play for in La Liga, Robert?
You said the question too quickly. I couldn't remember that. Sorry.
Gab, to make it 2-1.
I'm going to gamble and guess that it's Alexis Sanchez.
Good gamble. Worth the gamble. 2-1.
Just a terrible showing overall by Stuart Robson. Somehow, I'm sure he will be able to blame Arsene Wenger for his miserable performance. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much to Gab and Sid, who, of course, are with us. Stay tuned for more from Craig and Don as they stay on to answer your tweets in extra time. Thank you, as always, for your tweets. Let's address a couple of things, though, with Don and Craig. First, Craig, what's the relevance of the two balls behind you on the mantelpiece?
The wife, for some reason, likes those as little ornaments. She had them upstairs. And so I put them there, right, just to finish off the back shot. There's no reason to it. There are just a few little things like that around the house, you know. It's just women's touch.
I thought it might just be referring to what you talk mostly, but meanwhile, Don, what's this?
Are you not feeling this, Dan? I mean, this is 2 weeks in. I think it looks magnificent. I really do.
It looks something, that is for sure.
Right. I like it. I think it's hipstick.
It's that bad in moustache.
Don.
It's one of those moustaches and beers. My dad used to say, when you try to say, it's that bad if you put milk on it, the cat could lick it off.
Oh, beautiful.
It's only 2 weeks in. Give me time.
Right, Don, who will win a trophy first, Spurs or Pochettino?
Oh, Pochettino all day long. I don't know where Spurs are going to win their trophy. Let's hope Pochettino wins it at Newcastle. Being a Newcastle fan. Yeah, it'd be interesting if he gets that job, if he takes it. He will be adored up there. I don't know where Tottenham are going, Dan, to be honest. I thought I saw signs 18 months ago where I could see a pathway for Tottenham. They're getting close. Obviously, they got to a Champions League final. Regular team in the top four. But I worry for them. Not huge amounts of money to spend, and it might be inevitable that they sell some of their top players going forward. So my answer would be Pochettino.
It's amazing how
many teams do you support, Don? West Ham, Everton, Newcastle, Liverpool.
No, these are teams I all played for, but there was only one team I stood on the terraces, and that was Newcastle. I stood in the Gallagher end underneath the scoreboard from the age of, I don't know, 7 or 8 till about 17. So Newcastle's my club.
I tell you what, two things. I imagine.
Yeah, two things here. One, Don's done well to do the show whilst he's listening to Van Morrison in his headphones. And the other side of the coin is, if we cut Don's shot up now, then we're going to unveil the biggest Tom coat in Scottish history. When you look what's behind them. Look what's behind Hutchison.
Yeah, and I'll explain that, Craig. That is Alan Shearer's shirt from the Scotland-England game. Let me just move to one side.
Oh, you never
see that he signed that.
Do you know when they said to me, Johnny Swap, I said, I'm so disgusted we've been put out, I couldn't even think about it. But you were up all this time, all you were thinking about when we lost to England was how I'm going to sell that on eBay 25 years from now, that time.
I can't, because he signed it to Hutch, so it's worth absolutely nothing. Look, to Hutch, best wishes, Alan Shearer.
Well, there are other places, there are other people called Hutch in the world, you know. Somebody okay. Buy it.
I'm not selling it anyway. I'll put my Scotland back one on next week.
If you guys play today, would you take a chance on playing for a club like Newcastle, assuming you have at least 5 years there?
Assuming you'd have at least 5 years there, depends who the manager is, and depending what your feelings are. I mean, I'm like Alan Shearer, a Newcastle fan, and he went to Newcastle after winning the title with Blackburn, and he turned down big clubs in Europe, including Man United, because he's an absolute legend there. So the hometown pull would be strong, but depending on who your agent was in contact with and who were the clubs that were trying to sign you, I suppose.
Craig?
Yeah, I would. Great club. Great support. Fantastic stadium. There's always a great atmosphere there. Always loved playing at St James's Park. There's something about the towns, the cities with sort of one big club in them. And, you know, I absolutely. Ask Shaka about playing and, well, maybe just ask him about playing there. Don't ask him about anything else. just in case.
This has got to be from your burner account. Don, can you describe your emotions on scoring that famous Wembley goal against England?
The best moment ever, but it was the worst moment ever, because I'd gone in to the dressing room afterwards, and I saw the likes of Craig and all the boys crying, because obviously on aggregate we lost 2-1, but the emotion of scoring the goal was, I mean, it was just, I always liked, Dan, I always liked the hard and the tough occasions. I like being in the Lions Den. I used to love playing at Old Trafford and Anfield when your backs were against it, and we were 2-0 down going into that game at Wembley, and I'll stand by it, and I'm pretty sure Craig will agree, is to a man, we absolutely battered England on the night. I mean, we should have won by 3 or 4. David Seaman was pulling off saves after saves after saves. And we should have romped that game. But scoring the goal obviously gave us a massive lift and gave us the momentum in the game. And I was actually planning, not beforehand, I was never a planner of celebrating, but as soon as I scored it, the Scotland fans were way behind the goal to the right-hand side. And I was actually going to head for them and just jump on the fences there and go nuts. But all our substitutes were warming up in that corner and they sort of stopped me. So my celebration looks quite weak, but I tell you, the emotion inside me, I'll never get that back again. The adrenaline was something else.
I can confirm now, and I'm going to confirm now, that I, as disappointed as I was not crying in the dressing room at the end of the game. However, as well as we played and we beat England and we did play brilliantly that night, we might have went through and we might have won by more.
if he wasn't chasing Alan Shearer around before the end of the game saying, Alan, Alan, can I get your shot? Can I get your shot? Can we swap? And he went, I don't want your shot.
Did you not get David Beckham's that night, Craig? Did you not ask for any shirts? Did you not swap?
No, he asked for mine and I refused. All right, there you go. Okay. I've kept it to myself, but now that you asked, I've kept it to myself.
Don, would you have swapped that goal for Craig's goal in the World Cup?
Wait.
Yes. Ooh. Yes. Because I've not played in the World Cup. I didn't get there with Scotland. And as a kid, the World Cups that come to mind, 82, 86, Italia 90, those were the World Cups. But for Craig to go to a World Cup with Scotland and score, I would swap that goal, I think, in a heartbeat.
Did you play any different positions on the field when you were younger? Craig, you played basketball for Scotland. That's a very different position.
Yeah. Have I mentioned that before?
Look at Scottie Pippen there. Look at him. Larry Bird in there.
I tell you what, don't mock. I'm telling you what, I want bad. But I tell you, the answer is, strangely enough, no. I played more positions professionally than I did when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I just played middle of the park all the time. It wasn't until I went to Chelsea and really with Scotland that I started playing. I played fullback at times. I played left back, actually, and I came on in the Euro 96 game against England at Wembley, the game where Gazza scored that great goal. I came on at left back in that game. I played right back. I played centre half for Scotland. I played sweeper. And I did that for Chelsea as well. So, yeah, I did shift about in my professional career in different positions, but I never did it when I was a kid, no.
Don?
I think likewise with Craig, really. I think when you're young, you just play and you know, depending on what you are, you might be the best player, so you tend to be either in the middle of the park or up front where you can contribute to score goals. But like Craig, I was shifted everywhere. I've been a number four, a holder midfield player. I've been a number eight, box to box. I've played for Everton as a number 10. Sunderland, I used to play on the right-hand side. I can remember Graeme Souness, actually, when he got the Liverpool job, and he was trying to find a position for me because I was a young lad with, you know, loads of heart, and I loved to tackle, and I was quite boisterous, and I had an opinion sort of on the pitch. I didn't mind getting stuck in. So he was trying to find a position for me, and he said to me, I don't see you as a midfield player. I just don't see it in your game. He said, I could probably see you as a right back. You like a tackle. You know, you're a decent passer of the ball. You like to get stuck in. So he said to me, I'm going to play you in a reserve game this week, and if you do well at right back in the reserve game, you'll make your debut at the weekend. So this is one for the older viewers. So the reserve game was Nottingham Forest away, and I played up against a guy called Franz Carr, and he absolutely ripped me to shreds. And Graham, after the match, just looked at me quite calmly and went, "You're not a right back, are you?" And I went, "No." He was rapid.
Final question.
He was.
This is a much touted boxing match between me and Sevi. Craig, who would be the favourite in this boxing match between Dan and Seb?
I don't know, because we had this discussion the other day, because, you know, obviously you're a couple of guys that, you know, you're lucky if you weigh £100 sat on a horse soaking wet. You know what I mean? It's like, but I can see Sebi. I can see you. You're a sly little sod. I can see him rushing in like he always does, you know. One of those with, like, the fist going like that, flying in. I can see, you know, all anger. I can see you just waiting, ducking, and maybe catching him with, like, that. As I say, an undetected blow to the ribs to start with, then an uppercut. So I'm going to say I think you would be a little cuter than him. He's a kind of head-down, rush-in merchant. I'm going to say you, just.
I think it would be a terrible, terrible fight, no matter what happens. That is it. That brings us to the end of today's Extra Time. Thank you very much, Don. Enjoy that mustache.
Look forward to more Alan Shearer stories next week.
Yeah, thank you very much. Craig, we'll leave you go back to your balls. We'll be back, of course, on Monday for more of this. Until then, goodbye.